my pleasure to introduce our second speaker of the day. This is Sophia Frentz. She is a PhD candidate in genetics out of the Royal Melbourne Children's Hospital, and her work is on mitochondrial diseases. She is also the Vice President of the University of Melbourne Women in Science and Engineering Group.
Today I'm going to be talking to you about sort of gender equality and space, right? Because when we think about space, a lot of the time we think astronauts and we're like Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, which hilariously enough, when I was trying to practice this speech, I actually forgot who Neil Armstrong was and I had to Google the guy that's not Buzz Aldrin. But general talking, we know that the first two men who worked on the moon. And the stories we tell about space are typically about men. They're about the dudes who go to the moon. They're about, you know, Matt Damon on Mars. Like, in fiction as well as in reality, like, the guy in The Martian is this white dude. He's not John Cho, he's not Kerry Washington, both of which are films I would definitely watch, because can you imagine Kerry Washington on Mars? And Gravity was groundbreaking precisely because it starred a woman in the main role, as Sandra Bullock being in space haunted by George Clooney. But they're overwhelmingly for men, but the history of space travel doesn't reflect that, although it still kind of does, right? Because we still haven't sent a woman to the moon, and NASA has kind of gone, we're done with the moon, the moon's over, it's so last century, guys. But we've sent, like, 12, I'm guessing, dudes to the moon. As you just heard, I'm a biologist, so sometimes I will say things that might not be that true about space, but broadly, they're quite true. We've sent something like 12 dudes to the moon, and just at no point was NASA like, maybe we should send a woman to the moon. Maybe that'd be fun. Maybe they could do some science up there for us. No, just a whole bunch of dudes. And it's also reflected in the way we still talk about space travel a lot, because a lot of the time, people still refer to manned space travel, which NASA no longer does. NASA's full recommendation is that you refer to it as human space flight. But you'll get jerks, and Katie Mack, who some of you might have seen on Wednesday, like, always comes across jerks on Twitter who are like, but Katie, it is manned space flight. It definitely is. And it's like, NASA doesn't say that anymore. So if this is something you've been struggling with, the correct term is human space flight. Thank you. But this isn't something historical. This is something that happens today and constantly. Because, like, Russian female astronauts, like, I'm just going to read out this title because it's ridiculous. Russian female astronauts were asked how they would cope in space without men and makeup. And the astronauts quite rightly responded, we're very beautiful without makeup. We good. But it's that kind of treatment and that kind of discussion, because this was a crew of 8 female astronauts that Russia is cosmonauts that Russia is training to send to space. And it's amazing, because it's the first all-female crew that Russia has put together. And yet, in 2015, they were asked how they're going to deal without men. And their boss said, well, you know, women might be no worse than men. Might be not worse. And then he said, which is just, oh, it's one of my favourite things. You know, when you get 2 housewives in a kitchen, it just doesn't work out. And it's like, I don't even know where to start as to how wrong you are in that statement. Because it is so wrong on so many levels. And in case you think, well, you know, Russia, they're very backwards. They hate everyone. Women, the gays, probably, like, America most of the time. Like, Russia's not a good place. When we sent a probe to a comet, the man who was out there talking about it wore a shirt covered in women in lingerie and, like, didn't understand why this was wrong. Didn't understand why, like, wearing a shirt covered in, like, lingerie-clad women posed provocatively might send a message to young female budding astronauts out there that maybe it's not the most accepting environment for women. Maybe the men in your field will only see you as an object. And again, that happened in 2014. And to the researcher's credit, he has apologised. He has come out and said, I realise what I did was wrong. But the fact is, he didn't realise it was wrong before he put on the shirt to go on TV, on national television, that morning. And these are the kinds of stories we tell about women in space, instead of this kind of story. This woman is Margaret Hamilton, and she is standing beside the stack of code that she used to send man to the moon. That is the code that she wrote for the Apollo 11 mission that sent Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to the moon. It's really hard because I keep trying to go and say Neil Gaiman, and it's like, he hasn't gone to the moon. Come on. She also tried to correct a lot of bugs in the system that her bosses just didn't let her. She discovered that if you tried to start a pre-flight program while, like, on a mission, you would just wipe all of your flight data. And her bosses were like, that'll never happen, Margaret. That's crazy talk. And then someone proceeded to do it in the Apollo 13 mission. And so she had to then work out a way to send all of the flight data to a spaceship orbiting the moon and then get them back home. And she did that. And she is fantastic. And that pile of code is, like, as tall as her. And that's the kind of story we need to be saying. We need to be saying, you know who's amazing? Margaret Hamilton. Margaret Hamilton hand-wrote this code because this was in the 60s and they were terrible times for computing. Like, I am so glad I live today where I can just do a course online and be like, oh, now I know how to code Python, rather than being like, what are punch cards and how do they work? Does anyone know what the name of the first woman in space was? Who said that first? Good job. Yeah, it was Valentina Tereshkova. She's amazing. She has actually, I think about a year ago, maybe a year and a bit ago, came out and said that she wanted to be the first person to go to Mars. Essentially saying, well, you know, we can send people to Mars. The problem currently is bringing them back, and I'm old. I'm happy to die on Mars. Which is just the most amazing thing I have heard. She is someone whose name should be on everyone's lips. Like, she should be, it should be Yuri Gagarin and Valentina Tereshkova, but it often isn't. It's often just about the dudes, and we forget that there are these amazing women who are often, like, still alive today and say things like, send me to Mars. I will go to Mars. It will be great. And then we have women like Mae Jemison, and this is sort of leading into a really important point about why the stories we tell are so key. So Mae Jemison was the first African-American woman in space, and she has said in interviews, like, that she was inspired by Lieutenant Uhura in Star Trek, that she saw a black woman in space and she thought, I can go to space, because that woman on TV is pretending to be in space, and that is excellent. And by telling those kind of diverse stories, by talking about women in space, by talking about diverse people in space, it inspires people to shoot for the stars, right? To shoot for the moon. It inspires people to take those steps that they might not otherwise have thought of. And it brilliantly came full circle when Mae Jemison starred in Star Trek. And so Mae Jemison is one of the few people who you can have two pictures of her doing her job in space in very, very different contexts, which is really just one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It's not just astronauts as well. Often when we talk about ground crews, it's the pictures of NASA where everyone looks very, very tired all of the time. I don't know if you've noticed, but whenever I see the pictures of NASA, it's like, oh no, no windows. Oh babies, get your vitamin D supplements, please. I do not like that look, the look of that work environment. It looks very, very difficult. But then I'm also not a space scientist, so yeah, obviously not. These are the Indian women celebrating after the success of their Mars Orbiter mission, which is a mission that of a probe that is currently orbiting Mars that costs less to send to Mars than the film Gravity cost to make, which is just so beautiful. And the pictures that came out after that success are these women who are not only just, like, amazing Indian women, but they're amazing Indian women dressed like women. They're dressed in these beautiful saris. They're proud of who they are. And, like, they're celebrating. They're celebrating because they've succeeded. And often, like, we're told in the sort of stories that are created around women in STEM, women in space, are like, you have to, you know, play with the boys. You're a woman in a man's world. Wear some pants. But these are women in their saris, and they're so happy, and it's just one of the most beautiful pictures I've ever seen. And it was all over the internet, and then we forgot about it really quickly, and that kind of weirded me out because it's amazing. They sent a probe to Mars for less than a film, which is just such an incredible feat. And the deputy director of this, Nandini Harinath, is, like, the most amazing woman you've ever heard of. She is a deputy director, she has two kids, she, in interviews, is just like, yes, I want to be the first female director of the Indian Space Program. I will do this in, like, less than 10 years. I've got this. And she's so wonderful, and no one knows about her. And this is like quite distressing to me, because these women are doing amazing things. We have those role models right there within our reach, but we just don't talk about them. We don't tell their stories. We don't remember their names. We don't talk about the fact that Anushi Ansari, who was, she's the fourth sort of space tourist. She went to the ISS self-funded. She was the first Iranian-American woman in space, and she was the first female sort of space tourist. And she just kind of did it, and no one ever really blinked an eye or heard about it. No one really talked about the fact that Anushi Ansari has like done this wonderful thing, self-funded, who went to space because her family owns part of Telecom, and she's this amazing engineer. But yeah, we don't talk about the kind of women that do this. We talk about, you know, Elon Musk, who's doing amazing things, but we really need to be talking about these kind of people as well. Because this is so true. When we ignore half our talent, everything's so much harder. When you forget about women, when you don't encourage young girls who like space to go into astrophysics or go into astronomy or like become astronauts, then everything's that much harder. And it's something that people often say, but I don't think they often understand. It's like, if you're ignoring half your brain power, like, what are you doing? You have messed up somewhere, friend. Like, your life has gone very wrong, and now you're ruining science for everyone. We are not going to go to Mars. We are not going to make better spacecraft very quickly if we've only got, like, half the brain power, and half of that is just this giant echo chamber of men telling each other that they're very good all of the time. This is Sally Ride. Sally Ride was the first American woman in space. She is also she's also unfortunately deceased. She had pancreatic cancer and died relatively recently, which is not good. She is a bisexual. So it means somewhere there's a list of notable bisexuals, and me and Sally Ride are both on it, which is very nice. But also, and oh, I'm so mad about this. So, first American woman in space, did it in like 1983, because America was like a solid 15 years behind Russia at that point in time. And there's still not a film with a queer protagonist about like space and astronauts. Sally Ride did this like 30 years ago, guys. I need Hollywood to catch up. I need the films where, like, there are other bisexual protagonists that are doing these things. But, like, one of my favourite stories about Sally Ride, and I have a lot of, like, I love the idea of Sally Ride, the fact that she founded an entire organisation to encourage young women to go into science. One of my favourite stories is when she was going on her first mission, which was a 7-day mission, a group of NASA engineers came to her and they were like, okay, so you're going on a mission, you're the first woman we're sending into space. You'll need tampons. How many? Would 100 be the correct number of tampons you would need? For context, this is 100 tampons. And it might not look like much on Earth, right? But consider how little space there is in a spacecraft. Consider like how for every kilo, it's about $5,000 more to send things into space. But also for every kilo of weight you add, you need to add like 2/3 of a kilo of fuel to like send it up. And it's like, this is overkill. This is too many. And this is what Sally Ride said. She was like, that would not be the right number. And they were like, so 200? And it just completely blows my mind that at no point when these engineers were thinking, tampons, did they ask a woman? They didn't say, how many would you need, Sally Ride? They said, 100? At no point did they ask a doctor or a biologist? Were they like, what is this menstruation? How does it work? Does it happen constantly? Can women turn it off? All questions that like many American politicians should also ask their doctors. But like these engineers just didn't think of it. They were like, 100, probably. And when she sort of said no, and they were like, 200, and she was like, still wrong. They were like, well, we really want you to be safe. And she was like, 50 would be overkill. It is 7 days. I'm good. And there are a lot of like beautiful stories of engineers just not understanding how to ask questions. And like this is the sort of clearest example of like ignoring women in your histories and like not really asking them questions ever ever. So for a very long time, it was sort of assumed, and by assumed I mean assumed by male engineers, that if you got your period in space, you would get infected and probably die, because it wouldn't happen properly, and all of the endometrial lining would stay in your uterus, and it would get infected, and you would die. And if you ask most women, they will say, no, that's not correct. That's not right. In fact, this is recorded in a NASA oral history where Ruth Seddon is talking about how, like, retrograde flow would definitely happen. Like, all everything would just get back into your body. And then you would just, horrible things would occur. And the women were like, no, almost definitely not. Like, this is not a thing. And it's really quite obvious when you think about it, because as anyone who gets menstrual cramps can tell you, like, menstrual cramps are terrible. They are essentially a miniature version of labor pushing out the lining of one of your organs. You can still swallow in space. You can still menstruate in space. They sort of work on the same concept of, like, muscles push things around your body. So, it's all right. Which moves me on to my next point. The fact that if we're sending women to Mars, which we're going to, right? Like, I am fully on board with this. We can either send people like Valentina Tereshkova, who has probably passed menopause and so no longer has to worry about this. I say probably, I don't know her personally or intimately. But if we're sending women to Mars, we can't just do, like, this a whole bunch. Trip to Mars and back would take, like, 3 years. That's, like, a lot more than 100 tampons that you would need, and you just don't even want to think about sanitary pads, right? Like, if we're going to be sending women to space, and we're sending women away for that long, and they don't want to menstruate, because it is a choice, and, like, arguably, if I have chosen not to menstruate for, like, 5 years, and it is a good choice, my friends, we need to figure out a way to, like, assist them in that, right? Like, if you're going to Mars and, you know, you don't want to miss, right, there are many ways that you can prevent doing this. And, you know, I've already covered tampons, they wouldn't work. A moon cup is a little cup that you place inside of you to sort of catch the endometrial lining, and I don't even want to conceive of using that in zero gravity. Like, I've seen a lot of really cool videos of, like, Scott Hadfield, like, wringing flannels out in zero gravity. It's like, that's amazing. I don't even want to think about a moon cup in zero gravity. It is not going to be a good time. If you talk about the contraceptive pill, we have, oh, man. So, firstly, contraceptive pill on Earth goes off in about 3 years. Contraceptive pill in space would go off faster. That's just not the right things. Also, like, while they're smaller than tampons, if they ever come out of this packet, this is 3 months contraceptive tablets. And again, doesn't look like much, but you've got 3 years, you've got like 12 sets of these, you know, a bit more, quite heavy, and also a lot of them will probably go off and you need more than that to be safe, right? So that's a lot, and when you consider, again, like $5,000 a kilo to send things to space, like, you want to be getting rid of as much as you possibly can. And when you send drugs to space, they're also going to go off, right? Like, drugs on Earth go off. And part of that is the fact that, like, drugs just kind of sit around and spontaneously degrade. I didn't do well at first year chemistry, so please ignore me if I say things that are lies about chemistry. But essentially, like, a lot of gamma radiation is going to make your drugs go off faster, right? So if you're sending a lot of the contraceptive pill into space, that is going to go off faster. And there's also issues where, like, some women don't respond particularly well to particular types. Someone, when they would try and stop their menstruation from happening, just get 30 days of breakthrough bleeding, which is, like, also not something you want in space. Like, you don't want it on Earth. But, like, breakthrough bleeding for 30 days in zero gravity is just horrible to conceive of. You've also got contraceptive rings, which I don't have an example of. But, you know, they're about this big, and you use one of them a month, so, like, 36 of those, right? That's a lot. And then we have the two options that are actually good. So these are things like the implant, which is a small bar that gets inserted in your arm about here. And, you know, it's solid. It lasts for 3 years, give or take. And you have the Marina, or an intrauterine device. The Marina is my chosen brand. It is amazing. And so essentially, these are the two options that women who are going on long-term space travel have for suppression of menstruation. And so on the left there, you have the Implanon, and that's, you know, that's about this big. The main concern with the Implanon is that wild terrestrial women don't have problems with, like, the Implanon rubbing against literally everything they wear. When you're in space, it's generally quite a different environment. You get orthostatic tension in your upper body, which means your entire upper body swells slightly. And then you also have to be wearing weird clothes, right? Like, we don't casually wear space suits on Earth. We're not like, oh, look at my cool outfit today. I'm wearing my sweet EVA suit. But women in space do need to do that. And there's no research, although there is research upcoming, about the fact that, like, this might rub against your clothing, it might not be particularly comfortable, it could just not go well if you're in zero gravity. And then the one on the right is the Marina. And that's, look how small that is. And that is 5 years without menstruating, which is such a gift. And the quote on the bottom is from my friend when she was at the nurse for her most recent checkup, and the nurse said, you know, approximately when was your last period? And Fiona was like, approximately 8 years ago. I'm good. Just going to keep suppressing that menstruating. And that's, you know, that's an amazing tool that we have if we're going to Mars. And, like, the way the Marina works doesn't rely on drugs particularly. The way Marina works doesn't rely on, like, yeah, it just kind of sits inside your uterus and stops things from happening. And if, because it lasts for so long, it can be put in prior to astronaut training, and research can be done on whether it will be stable within it, because in some women, the Marina isn't particularly stable and it will just fall out, which sounds like an entirely horrifying experience to me, and dear Lord, I am so glad it has not happened to me. So there's all kinds of cool physiological differences between humans. And, like, some of the ones I know off the top of my head are, like, women have a greater risk of, like, swelling in their upper body when they go to space, which can result in more pressure on the heart. They can have more problems when it comes to bone density when they come back to Earth particularly. But women also have less of the, they have no evidence of the visual acuity going down, so when astronauts go to space, they lose visual acuity, which is bad, and also no one understands why. So if you're sending someone to space and you want them to not go blind, it's probably quite good to send a woman. They don't go entirely blind, they just have severely decreased visual acuity. Women also don't suffer from the hearing loss that male astronauts get. And so, like, those are really cool physiological differences. They're excellent, they're a fun time. But to take any one of those and say, well, then we should send no men to space ever again. Like, that's a rubbish reason. That's such a ridiculous thing to do. And so we have all of these amazing women that are either in fiction or in reality have gone to space. We have people like Mae Jemison, Margaret Hamilton. We have people like Kalpra Chawla and Chiaki Miani and Sally Ride and Valentina Tereshkova that we can be talking about, and we can be saying, these are the people that we look up to, these are the people that we want to be. We're just going to go to space, let's do it. Because, like, we're going to go to Mars. We're going to keep exploring outer space. Like, this is something that drives us. You look up at the stars and you think, I want to go to there. Like, we're going to keep going down this path. But in order to go down this path most successfully and in the best way for all of society, we need to do it in a way that includes everyone. To create the best future we possibly can, we have to include everyone in this path. Thank you.